how long do we have to stay here?" he asked.
"Dunno," I told him. "Till the end of the war, maybe, or till Mam comes to take us back."
"How long till the war ends?"
"Couple weeks, I guess, maybe longer."
"I want to go home," Jamie said.
He said that all the time, and I was tired of hearing it. I turned on him. "Why?" I said, nearly spitting the word. I kept my voice low, but rage I didn't know I felt gushed out of me. "So you can do anything you want, and I can do nothing at all? So I can't boss you? So I can be shut up in a room?" His round eyes filled with tears.
"No," he said, in a whisper. "I don't care if you boss me, and she probably won't shut you up, now you've got crutches and all."
"Everybody thinks I'm nasty back home. They think I'm some kind of monster."
"They don't," Jamie said, but he turned his face away.
"They won't."
He started crying in earnest, muffling his sobs in his pillow.
"You've got crutches," he said.
"Crutches don't change my foot," I said. "It's still the same. It still hurts. I'm still the same," Jamie said through sobs.
"At home, I know the words for things."
I knew what he meant. I knew how overwhelmed I felt sometimes, going into a shop full of things I'd never seen before.
"There's nothing good at home," I said. "You were hungry, remember?"
"No," said Jamie. "I wasn't ever hungry. I never was."
If he wasn't, it was only because I gave him most of the food. "I was," I said. "I was hungry, and I was alone,
and I was trapped. And right now, no matter what, you have to do what I say. You have to stay here with me. I'm the person who keeps you safe."
Jamie's sobs slowed. He looked up at me, his brown eyes still brimming with tears. He rolled over onto his back, and I pulled the sheet up to his chin. I patted his skinny shoulder.
"Is this safe?" he asked.
It didn't feel safe. I never felt safe. "Yes," I said.
"You're lying. I know you are."
Jamie flopped onto his side, turning his back to me. I lay flat on my back, breathing in the honeysuckle-scented air coming through the open windows. The curtains fluttered against the pale blue walls. I wasn't hungry. I fell asleep.
Chapter 13. The next time we went into town, we saw an enormous poster pasted to the brick wall near the train station. Jamie stopped to stare.
"What's it say?"
he asked. Miss Smith read it aloud, tapping the words with her fingers as she went. "Your courage, your cheerfulness, your resolution will bring us victory."
"That's stupid," I said. "It sounds like we're doing all the work."
Miss Smith looked at me and laughed. "You're right," she said. "It should be our courage," I said. "Our courage, our cheerfulness, our resolution will bring us victory."
"Absolutely," Miss Smith said.
"I'll write the War Office and suggest a revision." I couldn't tell if she meant it or not. I hated when I didn't understand her. "I shouldn't underestimate you, should I?" Miss Smith went on. "How should I know?" I scowled. "Oh, come on, you cranky child," she said, touching my shoulder lightly. "You can help me pick out the veg." Jamie was tugging on my arm. He pointed across the street to Stephen White, holding on to the arm of a very old man. Actually, I saw, it was the old man holding on to Stephen.
"A friend of yours?" Miss Smith asked.
"No," I said, "it's Billy's brother." Miss Smith nodded. "You can go and say hello." felt funny doing it, but I did want to know why Stephen hadn't gone home with the rest of his family. I made my way across the street. Stephen saw me. He stopped, and when he did, the old man stopped too, turning odd milky eyes toward me. Stephen gestured toward the crutches.
"Good," he said. "You should have had those before."
I thought of him carrying me to the station, and my face went hot.
"Who's this?" barked the old man. "Who are you talking to? Somebody new?"
He was looking straight at me, the old coot. Stephen cleared his throat.
"It's Ada," he said. "From our lane, Ada."
The man said crossly,
"That's not the way you do a proper introduction. Haven't I taught you?"
"Yes, sir." Stephen took a deep breath.
"Sir, may I present Miss Ada Smith from London. Ada, this is Colonel Robert McPherson, British Army retired. I live with him here."
The old man stuck one of his hands into the air.
"And now you shake my hand, Miss Smith," he said. "If you're from the same place the boy's from, nobody's taught you proper manners either. You shake my hand, and you say, 'Nice to meet you, Colonel McPherson.'"
I touched his gnarled, dry hand. He snatched my fingers and shook them up and down.
"Say, 'Nice to meet you, Colonel McPherson,'" he ordered.
"Nice to meet you, Colonel McPherson," I said.
"And it's a pleasure to meet you, Miss Ada Smith. If you're a friend of Stephen's, you must come around for tea."
He let go of my hand. I wiped it against my skirt. Not because his hand had been dirty. It hadn't. But because touching a stranger seemed like such an odd thing to do. Stephen was grinning, as though he found the whole exchange funny. "How come you didn't go home?" I asked him.
"Oh," he said, cutting his eyes toward Colonel McPherson. "Mam thought it better if I stayed here for a while."
"No, she didn't," I said. "She said—" Stephen smacked me on the arm, hard. I glared at him. He nodded his head toward the old man, frowning.
"What?"
I asked.
"I'll talk to you later," Stephen said.
"Later, okay?"
"Okay,"
I said, still puzzled. Back on the other side of the street, Miss Smith and Jamie stood in front of a second poster.
"This one's better," Jamie said.
"Freedom is in peril," Miss Smith read. "Defend it with all your might."
It was better.
"What's might?"
I asked.
"I might have some tea," said Jamie.
"No."
"Well, yes,"
Miss Smith said. "But in this case, it means strength, force. Defend it with everything you've got."
"Freedom is in peril," Jamie shouted, running ahead. He waved his arms wildly. "Freedom is in peril. Defend it with everything you've got."
"What's freedom?" I asked, as Miss Smith and I followed.
"It's..."
"I'd say it's the right to make decisions about yourself," Miss Smith said. "About your life.
Like, this morning we decided to come into town."
"More like deciding that you want to be a... I don't know, a solicitor, when you grow up. Or, perhaps a teacher. Or deciding that you'd like to live in Wales. Big decisions. If Germany invades, we'll probably still be able to go shopping, but we might not get to decide much else." As usual, I mostly didn't understand her, but I was tired of trying.
"Stephen White has to live with a grumpy old man," I said.
"I noticed," Miss Smith said. "I'm sorry to see the Colonel looking so frail. He was one of Becky's fox-hunting friends. One of the hunting, shooting, and fishing sort. I didn't realize he was so old."
"He made me touch his hand," I shuddered.
"That's just manners," Miss Smith said.
"So he said."
Miss Smith grinned. I didn't know why.
"Skeptical child," she said,
making me frown even harder. She grabbed the end of my plait and swung it. Your courage, your cheerfulness, your resolution, she was saying it wrong. I scowled. Will bring you victory, my dear.
We'd reached the greengrocer's. Jamie waited for us, holding open the shop door. I flicked my plait away from Miss Smith. I wasn't going to ask what any more words meant. I was so tired of words. But Miss Smith looked at me and answered my question anyway.
Victory, she said, means peace.
Chapter 14. A few days later, the teacher who had been with us on the train came by the house to say that school was starting. The village didn't have an empty building big enough to hold the evacuated children, so the evacuees had to share the village school. The regular village students would attend with their regular teachers from 8 until noon, and then the evacuees and the evacuated teachers would go from 1 in the afternoon until 5. The teacher gave Miss Smith directions to the school. "We'll see you Monday afternoon," she said to Jamie as she got up to leave. We'd all four been sitting in the main room of Miss Smith's house, on the squishy purple chairs and sofa. Miss Smith had made tea. Now she smiled quizzically at the teacher and said, "Ada too, of course." I don't know how I looked, but Jamie's and the teacher's mouths fell open. The teacher's mouth closed first. "Ada's not on our list," she said. "I told you that when I gave you their mother's address. We've only got Jamie down." Jamie said, "Ada's not allowed to go outside." I said fiercely, "That's rubbish. It was only ever in London, and you know it."
"But not school," said Jamie.
I'd never been. Never thought about going.
But why not?
I could get there on my crutches. It wasn't that far. Miss Smith argued that lists didn't matter. Surely the lists weren't accurate. And besides, many of the children had already gone back to London. There had to be room for me.
Room? Yes, the teacher said slowly. But is it appropriate?
She stood and took a book off one of Miss Smith's shelves.
Here, she said, holding it open and out to me. Read a bit of that.
I looked at the page. The rows of marks blurred and swam before my eyes. I looked up. The teacher nodded. Miss Smith came over and put her arm around me. I tried to pull away, but Miss Smith held on.
"You see," the teacher said softly, "she isn't educable."
I didn't know what educable meant. I didn't know if I was educable or not.
"She simply hasn't been taught," Miss Smith said. "She's far from stupid. She deserves a chance."
The teacher shook her head. "It wouldn't be fair to the others." The door clicked softly as she left. Miss Smith grabbed my shoulders with both hands.
"Don't cry," she said. "Don't cry. She isn't right. I know you can learn. Don't cry."
"Why would I cry? I never cried." But when I shook myself free of Miss Smith's grasp, tears shook loose from my eyes and slid down my cheeks. Why would I cry? I wanted to hit something, or throw something, or scream. I wanted to gallop on butter and never stop. I wanted to run. But I couldn't run, not with my twisted, ugly, horrible foot. I buried my head in one of the fancy pillows on the sofa, and then I couldn't help it. I did cry. I was so tired of being alone. Miss Smith sat down on the sofa beside me. She put her hand on my back. I squirmed away.
"Don't worry," she said,
almost like she cared about me.
"They're wrong. We'll find another way."
"I know you aren't stupid," she continued. "Stupid people couldn't take care of their brother the way you do. Stupid people aren't half as brave as you. They're not half as strong." "Stupid, simple, educable,
thoughtful. All just words. I was so tired of meaningless words.
That night, after our baths, Miss Smith came to the doorway of our bedroom before we fell asleep. She hesitated.
"I've brought something," she said. "This was my favourite book when I was a little girl. My father used to read it to me at bedtime. I thought I'd start reading it to you." I turned my head away. "More words?" Jamie asked.
"Why, miss?"
"I wish you'd quit calling me miss," she said, pulling the chair close to Jamie's side of the bed. "My name is Susan. You should call me that." "I'm reading to you because I think you'll enjoy it," Jamie said.
"Why would we enjoy it?"
Miss Smith didn't answer. She said, "This book is called The Swiss Family Robinson. Listen." She cleared her throat and began. "For many days we had been tempest-tossed. 6 times darkness closed over a wild and terrific scene. I buried my head deeper into my pillow. The drone of her voice sounded like a fly buzzing against a window. I fell asleep. In the morning, though, those first words stuck in my head until I couldn't stand it any more.
'Miss,'
I said at breakfast,
'what's tempest-tossed?'
Miss Smith looked at me over her mug of tea.
'Caught in a storm,' she said. 'Wind and rain and lightning. And if you're in a boat, at sea, you get tossed from side to side. You're all thrown about because of the storm.' I looked at Jamie. 'That's us,' I said, 'all thrown about. We're tempest-tossed.' He nodded. I turned back to Miss Smith.
'What's educable?'
She cleared her throat.
'Able to be educated,' she said. 'Able to learn. You are plenty able to learn, Ada. You are educable. I know you are. That teacher is wrong.'
A plane zoomed overhead. Jamie jumped up. We heard and saw planes all the time now, because of the airfield, but Jamie never tired of watching them. I got up to go out too.
'Ada,' Miss Smith said, 'if you like, this morning I'll start to teach you to read.'
I edged away.
'No, thank you,' I said, using the manner she taught me. 'I want to go look at the planes.'
She shook her head. 'That's not true.'
'I want to talk to Butter.'
Miss Smith leaned forward.
'You're perfectly capable of learning. You mustn't listen to people who don't know you. Listen to what you know, yourself.'
What I knew, I'd learned looking out a single window. I knew nothing. Words she used, capable, tempest-tossed.
Even little words. Sea. What was a sea? Boats came down the River Thames. Was a sea the same as a river? I knew nothing, nothing at all. 'I need to see the pony,' I said.
She sighed. 'Suit yourself,' she said, and turned away.
I'd found a brush in the storage room, and I used it all over Butter's yellow coat. Dust and loose hair flew up. I could tell he liked it.
'Good, isn't it?' I asked him. 'Gets the itches out.'
My skin didn't itch the way it used to. The stinky lotion cleared up the rough patches on my skin, and my head felt better now that Miss Smith brushed my hair for me every morning. She braided it for me into a single plait down my back, so it stayed neater, out of my way in the wind, and wasn't as tangled at night. She brushed me the way I brushed Butter, which was odd, no matter how I thought about it.
'Look!' Jamie cried, pointing to the sky. 'It's a different one.'
He ran across the pasture, trying to get a better view of the plane. I rode Butter twice around the field before he got me off. At lunch, Miss Smith said she would walk Jamie to school for the first day. 'You'll be all right by yourself, Ada,' she asked, 'or you could come.' I shook my head. I wasn't going near the school. And that turned out to be lucky. The minute Miss Smith left with Jamie, I climbed back onto Butter. And so I was there when the strange horse jumped into our field. Chapter 15. It happened like this. I was walking Butter in circles, practicing making him turn. I heard a sound like hoofbeats coming from the road, and I stopped to look, but couldn't yet see anything through the trees. A plane took off from the airfield and screamed straight over our heads, just as a horse and rider came into view. Butter didn't mind the plane. He saw dozens of planes take off every day now. But the other horse, a big brown one, wheeled in fright. His rider pulled the rein sharply to keep him from bolting. But he wheeled again, and then jumped forward, off the road and onto the verge, nearly chesting the stone wall into our field. The rider bounced loose in the saddle, and the horse, frantic, made a sudden leap up and over the wall. The rider tumbled sideways and disappeared. The strange horse galloped straight for Butter, reins flying, loose stirrups walloping his sides. Butter spooked and spun, tossing me, and together both horses ran to the far side of the field. They galloped about for a bit, the idiots, but I wasn't paying attention to them. I ran for the fallen rider as fast as my bad foot would let me. I'd recognized her, the little iron-faced girl, the one who'd called me out. She lay face down in the muddy weeds on the verge. I scrambled over the wall just as she, blinking, rolled herself over. She opened her eyes and let out a string of curses that would have been at home in my lane, let alone the dockyards. She ended with, "I hate that stupid bloody horse." Bloody is not something Miss Smith let Jamie or me say. It was a swear word, a bad one. "I hate him," she repeated, looking at me. "Are you much hurt?" She started to sit up, then fell back, nodding. "Dizzy," she said, "and my shoulder hurt something awful. Bet I broke my collarbone." She touched a place below her neck and winced. "My mother broke hers last year, hunting. Easy to do. Where's the wretched horse?" I looked over the wall. "Grazing next to the pony. Acts like nothing's wrong." She pulled herself slowly to a sitting position. "He would. I hate him. He belongs to my brother." She started to stand, gave a small cry, and sat back down with a thump. Her skin went pale, then an interesting shade of grey. "Better stay still," I told her. I went to fetch the horse. His front foot was tangled in the reins, but otherwise he seemed fine, and he stood politely while I untangled him. He was bigger than Butter, and far more handsome. Beautiful shiny coat, long elegant legs. He sniffed my hands the way Butter often did. "No treats," I told him. I started to walk him back to the girl, but honestly, my foot hurt, and also, the horse was so pretty. I pulled the reins over his head, put my good foot into the left stirrup, and hauled myself aboard. The saddle felt snug and comfortable after the loose sliding expanse of Butter's bare back. I couldn't put my bad foot into a stirrup, but I liked the feel of the stirrup on my good foot. I gathered the reins up, and the horse delicately arched his neck. I thumped him with my heels, and he nearly bolted. My mistake. Clearly the horse responded to much softer signals than Butter. I pulled him back, and used my legs very gently. He walked forward, a fine, long-striding, loopy sort of walk. Now the girl was standing, hanging onto the wall. She called, "Take him around by the gate." I had a better idea. The horse had jumped in. It could jump out. I kicked him forward. He took a few enormously bouncy strides, then settled into a nice smooth run. "Oh," I thought, my breath catching in my throat. This was what it felt like to move fast without pain.
I pulled on the reins and aimed the horse straight for the wall. He never hesitated, up and over in one smooth bound. Flying. I held on to his mane with both hands and flew with him. We landed together on the other side. I laughed out loud.
"Show off," the girl said, but she was laughing too. "Lucky you, there isn't another airplane."
"Lucky me," I said. "Can you ride him now?" She moved her right arm experimentally and winced.
"I'll never be able to hold him," she said. "Not one-handed, and my head hurts terribly. Can I get up behind you?"
I scooched forward. The saddle was plenty big. I took my foot out of the stirrup and helped pull her onto the horse.
"You can have the foot things," I said.
She put her good arm around my waist.
"They're called stirrups," she said, slipping her feet into them.
"Just go back the way I came from, and walk, please. My head feels like it's smashed in two. A trot would be the end of me."
Her name was Margaret.
Her mother was the head of the Women's Volunteer Service, which was why she was in charge of the evacuees.
"But that's not all," Margaret said.
"She does war work all the time. She's trying to stay busy, so she doesn't have time to worry about Jonathan.
She wants to win the war herself before he's part of the fighting."
Jonathan, Margaret's brother, was learning to fly planes at a different airfield, far from here. He'd left Oxford to do it, Margaret said.
"You talk like our evacuees," she said. "The same funny accent."
I said, "You talk funny to me." She laughed.
"I guess.
But you can ride, and our evacuees, the ones staying with us, I mean, are all terrified of horses. Where'd you learn to ride in London?"
"Didn't. Just teaching myself here."
"Well, you're pretty good."
"On a posh horse like this one, anyone would be," I said.
"Our pony has me off half a dozen times a day."
"Ponies are snakes," she replied. "Sneaky devils. You should see what mine gets up to."
It turned out the horse we were riding was her brother's hunter, and her mother was making her keep it exercised.
"Just until I leave for school," she said.
"Which should have been last week, only they're moving the school, evacuating it, I suppose. So we're starting late. And I hate this horse, I do, and he hates me. Goes like a lamb for anybody else. Mum won't believe me, and he's worse when he's by himself. And he won't pony with my mare. So I'm stuck fighting him alone for an hour a day. All the stable lads have run off to join up, and Grimes is overworked, and there's nobody to go with me." All this talk, which I only half understood, seemed to suddenly exhaust her. She sagged against my shoulder.
"You're all right?" I asked.
"Not really," she said. "I feel sick." The horse swung authoritatively around a corner. I hoped he knew where he was going. He seemed to, and anyway, Margaret wasn't telling me anything different. She swayed suddenly. I wished I was behind her, so I could hold her steady.
"Maggie," I said.
There was a Margaret on our lane, and everyone called her Maggie.
"Maggie, hang on."
I pulled her hand farther around my waist. She leaned her head between my shoulder blades, muttering to herself. I worked hard to keep the horse steady, but walking fast. I didn't know how far we had to go.
"My mother likes Jonathan better than me," Maggie said more loudly. "She doesn't really like girls. She'll do anything for him, but she's always cross with me."
"My mam likes my brother better too," I said. "She hates me because of my foot." I could feel her lean over to look at my bad foot. I was glad that it was bandaged. She swayed, off balance.
"Careful," I said.
"Hmm," she said.
"A brewer's cart ran over it," I said.
"Oh," Maggie said. "Well, that's a silly reason to hate you." The horse clomped on. Maggie's head bounced against my shoulder. It wasn't a brewer's cart, I said, after a pause. It's a clubfoot. That word the doctor had used.
Oh, clubfoot, her voice slurred. I've heard of that. We had a foal born with a clubfoot.
The horse turned again, down a long gravel drive planted on both sides with straight rows of trees. He stepped faster now, swinging his head. Maggie groaned.
I'm going to be sick, she said. Not on the horse, I said.
She said, and was, but she leaned over far enough that most of the sick missed the saddle.
Then she nearly fell off.
I grabbed her. The horse swung his head impatiently.
He's always happier going home, Maggie murmured. Rotten bugger.
What's a foal? I asked.
What? Oh, a baby horse. We had a horse born with a club foot. That's what Grimes called it.
She swayed again.
I feel awful.
I tried to imagine a little horse with a twisted hoof. Butter's hooves were long and curling, but they didn't twist.
What would a horse do if it couldn't walk?
No crutches for horses.
Were there?
Did it die then? I asked.
What?
Oh, the horse. The clubfoot horse.
No, Grimes fixed it. Grimes and the farrier.
The trees opened up and in front of us was a huge stone building. Big like I imagine the dock warehouses must be. Big like the London train station.
It couldn't be right.
Whatever the place was, it wasn't a house. The horse shook his head at my attempts to rein him in. Instead of heading straight for the massive building, he went around to the side, to what even I could recognize was a stable. An elderly man came forward at a sort of running limp. Grimes, I thought.
"What's happened?" he asked.
"Oh, Maggie's hurt," I told him.
She tumbled sideways into his arms. He staggered, but held on to her.
"She fell off and smacked her head," I said.
"Hurt her shoulder, too." Grimes nodded.
"Can you stay with the horse a moment? I'll get her to the house."
"Of course," I said, trying to make my voice sound like Maggie's. Grimes fixed a horse with a clubfoot. Fixed a clubfoot? How?
He carried Maggie away. I slid off the horse, a very long way to the ground, and looked around. There were stalls just like the closed-up ones at Miss Smith's house, only more of them, and fancier, and mostly occupied. Horses looked over the open tops of the stalls' half-doors, their ears pricked with interest. Some of them made little murmuring sounds. I led Maggie's brother's horse into an empty stall. The horse thrust his head into a water bucket, and then into a pile of hay. I got the saddle off him, not hard, just buckles under the flat bits, and slung it over the door, then got the bridle off. I shut the horse in the stall and carried the tack and bridle to their storeroom, which I found without any trouble. One row of racks held saddles, and another bridles, and I put the kit I held into the empty spaces. I wandered around, looking at the other horses, until Grimes returned.
"Thank you," he said. "She's in bed now, and my lady has phoned for the doctor. Don't think there's anything more we can do. She doesn't know where she is right now. You get that sometimes with a smack on the head."
"She seemed all right at first," I said. "She got worse as we were going."
"Well, I'm not surprised."
He pointed to my foot.
"What happened? You get hurt too?"
I looked down. A small blood stain was seeping through the bandage.
"Oh," I said, "it does that, sometimes, when I don't have my crutches."
I hesitated, then added, "It's a club foot." Grimes didn't offer to fix it. He nodded and said,
"I'll give you a ride home in the car, then."
Grimes took me home very nicely. He thanked me for helping Miss Margaret. I told him I was glad to, especially since it meant I got to ride such a big fancy horse. He laughed a bit at that and patted my hand, which was odd, but okay with me. I felt completely happy as I went through the front door. I was totally unprepared for Miss Smith's rage. Chapter 16. She came at me like a small yellow-haired witch, eyes blazing.
"Where have you been?" she shouted. "I've nearly gone to the police. Pony's in the field with a bridle on. You're nowhere. It's almost 4 o'clock. What on earth were you thinking?"
She came toward me. I ducked, my arms around my head.
"I'm not going to hit you," she roared. "Though I feel like it. You half deserve a whipping, making me worry like that."
Worry? Worry the way I worried over Jamie in London? I dropped my hands to my lap. I'd sat down in one of the purple chairs and stared at her, perplexed.
"I know you don't like strangers," she said, more quietly. "I couldn't imagine a reason you'd go into town. I didn't think you'd go to the airfield, but I went there to ask anyway, and they hadn't seen you. Here it's the first time I left you alone. I couldn't imagine what could go wrong. I didn't have any idea where you could be."
"I thought I was allowed to go outside," I said. My foot hurt, worse than it had for days. I hadn't walked so far without my crutches since I'd first come here. I had a scratch down my arm, too, that had left a thin trail of blood.
"You can't leave without telling me," Miss Smith said. She looked less angry, but still unpredictable. "You've got to let me know where you go."
How could I have done that?
"I had to help Maggie," I said. I told her about the horse, how the plane spooked it, how Maggie fell. Miss Smith snorted.
"Maggie? Who's Maggie?"
I tried to explain. I told about the big horse, and the house, and stables.
"The Honourable Margaret Thornton?" Miss Smith asked, her eyes widening. "Lady Thornton's daughter?"
I shrugged. "I suppose she's got a brother called Jonathan.
The girl we met with Lady Thornton last week in the market."
I nodded. Miss Smith sat down in the other chair.
"The whole story?" she demanded.
I told the whole story, except for the part where Maggie said bad words. Miss Smith straightened up. Her face looked grim.
"So," she said, "you rode Jonathan Thornton's prize hunter double with Miss Margaret, back to her home?"
"Yes," I said.
"I don't believe you," Miss Smith said.
I didn't know what to say. I told lies, of course I did. But I wouldn't lie about this. I'd been helpful. I'd done a good job getting Maggie and the horse home. Grimes had said so. He tipped his cap to me when I got out of the car.
"I wouldn't know where she lived," I said, "if it wasn't true."
"Oh, I believe you saw the house," Miss Smith said bitterly. "I believe Miss Margaret rode by, and you saw them and followed them. Look at the state you're in, foot bleeding again and everything. I believe you saw Margaret, the horse, and the house. I just don't believe any of the rest of it."
My mouth opened, then shut. I didn't know what to say.
"Go to your room," Miss Smith said. "Wash yourself off in the bathroom, then go to your room and stay there. I don't want to see you again today. I'll send Jamie up with some supper once he's home."
Hours later, Jamie came up with a plate for me.
"How was school?" I asked.
"I hate it," he said, his eyes dark. "I'm never going back."
Later still, Miss Smith came up with her horrible book. She sat down on the chair on Jamie's side of the bed, and she opened the book without looking at me.
I ignored her too.
Jamie snugged himself into the blankets.
"What happens next?"
he asked, as though the book was something he cared about.
"You'll see," Miss Smith said, smiling at him. She opened the book and started to read.
Next morning at breakfast, Jamie said again he wasn't going back to school.
"Of course you are," Miss Smith said. "You want to learn to read? Then you can read Swiss Family Robinson all by yourself."
Jamie looked up at her through his eyelashes.
"I'd rather you read it to me," he said sweetly.
Miss Smith smiled at him, and the thought ran through me that I hated them both. Out in the field that afternoon, I couldn't make butter go faster than a walk. I tried and tried. I kicked and squeezed with my legs. I even snapped a branch off a tree and smacked Butter's side with it. He lurched forward for a few stumbling steps, but dropped back almost immediately to his usual shuffle. It wasn't his fault that he wasn't elegant like Jonathan's horse. But I was sure he could do better if he tried. Miss Smith opened the back door.
"Ada!" she called. "Come here, please."
"Right." I pretended I hadn't heard and turned Butter so our backsides faced her.
"Ada!" she called again. "You've got a visitor."
"Maggie? Grimes?"
"Ma'am."
I slid off Butter, pulled the bridle off his head. I wasn't going to get chewed out for leaving it on him again. Hobbled to my crutches, leaning against the wall, and went into the house as quickly as I could. The visitor was Lady Thornton. She was smiling. Her face looked different when she smiled.
"She's come to thank you," Miss Smith said, in an oddly stiff voice. I stood in the doorway, staring at them, hiding my right foot behind my left. To break the silence, I said, "How is she? Maggie, I mean."
Lady Thornton, Maggie's mum, patted the empty spot on the sofa beside her. I sat down on it, folded my hands, and slid my right foot behind my left.
"She's much better today, thank you," Lady Thornton said.
"She woke with a headache, but she knows where and who she is."
"She seemed all right when she first came off," I said. "She got worse as we went on."
Lady Thornton nodded. "Head injuries can be like that. She tells me she doesn't remember much of what happened. She remembers you were there, but that's about all. Grimes, in the stable, told me how you brought her home." I glanced at Miss Smith. Her face still looked stiff, like it was made from cardboard. I said, nodding toward her, "She didn't believe me, that I rode that horse and all."
Lady Thornton opened a box near her feet. "I might not have believed it myself, without a witness. That's not an easy horse."
"He likes me."
It slipped out before I thought, but I realized it was true. Jonathan's horse did like me.
Now Lady Thornton's face looked strained. "Then you're the third person that animal has ever actually liked, after Grimes and my son."
She shook her head once, sharply, and her face took on its official look, the iron face look.
"I brought over some clothing for you and your brother. Your brother's is from an assortment of village families. Yours is mostly from my daughter, things she's outgrown. Here."
She laid a pair of yellow pants and a pair of ankle boots across my lap. I stared at them. The pants were made of a thick, tough fabric, with legs that ballooned wide at the top, then narrowed and buttoned below the knee. I recognized them. Maggie had worn a pair just like them the day before.
"For riding," I said.
I'd never worn pants before.
"It would be easier on Butter." Lady Thornton nodded.
"Yes, I'm sure Miss Smith's helping you, but I didn't think she'd be able to find you the proper clothes."
Miss Smith said, very softly, "I haven't helped her. She's done it on her own."
Lady Thornton looked me up and down.
"Margaret needs to stay in bed a few days. She won't be able to ride again before she leaves for school. but if you have questions about horses, you can always go to our stables and ask Grimes. I know he'll help you. I noticed she wasn't offering to help me herself. I said, Butter doesn't want to go fast. I don't know how to make him. She gave a little laugh and tapped my knee as she stood. Persistence, she said. Ponies are stubborn until they know who's boss. Enjoy the new things. Miss Smith saw her out. When she came back in, she sat down in Lady Thornton's place. I'm sorry, she said, after a moment's pause. I didn't mean to call you a liar. Sure she did. I shrugged. I am one. I know. She began to empty the rest of the box of clothes. Shorts for Jamie, sweaters, shirts. Then she straightened. No, she said. That's wrong. I don't know that. We both know you sometimes tell lies, but I can't say that it makes you a liar. Do you understand what I mean? Blouses, sweaters, skirts for me, a red dress with lace on the cuffs, coats for winter. I touched the girl's coat, Maggie's coat. Will I still be here in winter? I don't know, Miss Smith said. Do you understand what I just said? The difference between lying and being a liar? I shrugged. Miss Smith persisted. If you have to tell lies, or you think you have to keep yourself safe, I don't think that makes you a liar. Liars tell lies when they don't need to make themselves look special or important. That's what I thought you were doing yesterday. I was wrong. I didn't want to talk about it. Why is Maggie going away for school? I asked instead. Why doesn't she go to school where Jamie does? Rich people educate their children at boarding schools, Miss Smith replied. Margaret won't have to leave school at 14 to work, like most children do. She'll stay at school until she's 16 or 17. If the war's over by then, she'll probably go to finishing school. She might even go to university. What kind of school did you go to? I asked. A boarding school, she said. Not because my family was rich, they weren't. I was bright, and my father is a clergyman, and some schools offer scholarships to the bright daughters of clergymen. What's a clergyman? You know, a vicar, a man who runs a church. The "you know" kept me from asking more. Churches are where the bells are. Yes, said Miss Smith. Only they aren't going to be allowed to ring the bells any more. Only in case of invasion, to warn us. I smoothed the pants with my hand. Tomorrow I'd wear them. The left boot, too. Ada, Miss Smith said, I wish I'd believed you. I darted a quick glance at her and shrugged again. Chapter 17. When Jamie came home, it was obvious he'd been crying, but he wouldn't say why. He wet the bed in the night and woke up miserable. Outside, grey clouds were spitting rain. I can't go to school in the rain, Jamie said. Of course you can, Miss Smith replied. She looked awful, her hair every which way and great dark circles under her eyes. She held her mug of tea in both hands and stared into it. I ain't going, Jamie said. Don't start with me, Miss Smith replied. We sat down to breakfast, and a plane blew up at the airfield. It crashed, I guess. It didn't blow up in the air. It blew up because it slammed into the ground. The gas tank ruptured. We learned that later. It sounded like a bomb exploding. Like a bomb in Butter's pasture. We all jumped up, knocking over dishes and chairs. I ran toward the door, toward Butter, but Miss Smith grabbed me and Jamie and pushed us beneath the table.
After a moment, when nothing else happened, she got up and looked out the window.
"Oh," she said, "it's an airplane."
Under billows of black smoke across the road, we could see orange flames and twisted pieces of metal. Jamie cried out and would have run to the airfield, but Miss Smith held him back.
"No civilians," she said. "No civilians, not now. See, they're getting the fire out."
We could see servicemen and women, tiny in the distance, working frantically all around the burning plane.
"Who was the pilot?" Jamie asked. "Who was the crew?"
"We don't know them," Miss Smith said, stroking his hair.
"I knew them," Jamie said. I wasn't sure how Jamie could know them. There was a big fence around the airfield now, and he knew he wasn't allowed there, though of course that wouldn't really stop him. But I didn't say anything. I wasn't going to call him a liar, not over a dead airman.
"I wonder what kind of plane it was," Miss Smith said.
"A Lysander," Jamie said. "A transport plane. It could have had 10 people on board."
We looked at him. He said, "That's what it sounded like before the crash." I was so used to the sound of planes, I never paid attention to them anymore. The different kinds of planes didn't sound different to me. Jamie leaned into Miss Smith's arms. She held him tight, rocking him softly back and forth. I stood still, absorbing what I was seeing. Jamie turning for comfort to someone other than me. We ran into Lady Thornton in the village when we were shopping later that week, and she told us that Maggie, she called her Margaret, of course, had gone off to her school and wouldn't be home until Christmas. I was sorry not to see her again. I wanted to talk to her when she hadn't just been hit on the head. I wanted to know if she'd still like me when she wasn't woozy. Jamie kept hating school. He skipped twice, and after that the teacher wrote Miss Smith a note, and Miss Smith started to walk him to school every afternoon. Once he was inside the building, he was trapped. I knew how it felt to be trapped. I'd been trapped all summer in our flat. I'd been trapped all my life in our flat. But I couldn't understand why Jamie hated school. Most of the kids from our neighbourhood back home were there, including all of Jamie's friends, except Billy White. They had breaks where they got to run and play in the schoolyard. Plus, pretty soon, he'd be able to write and read, and then Miss Smith wouldn't have to read us Swiss Family Robinson at night anymore. Jamie could read it to himself.
"I don't want to talk about it," he said, when we asked him.
"I'm sorry," he said, when he wet the bed, which he did every night now. "I want to go home," he told me.
"You'd miss Miss Smith," I said nastily.
"I wouldn't," he said. "I'd have Mam."
I could imagine Mam might have softened toward us, or at least toward Jamie. She probably missed us at least a little. "They have school at home too," I said. He shrugged. "Mam won't make me go." I knew this was probably true. Meanwhile, Miss Smith was in a fit because Mam hadn't responded to any of her letters. She asked me, "Does your mother know how to read?" I shrugged. "How would I know?" "Surely there's a social worker, a priest, someone who could read it to her and write out her reply?" "Probably there was, but Mam would never ask them."
"Why does it matter?" I asked.
"So long as Mam knew where we were and could come get us when she decided to."
"Do you want her to come take us home?"
Miss Smith gave me a strange look.
"I do not. You know why it matters." "I didn't. Sometimes I was so angry about everything I didn't know."
Miss Smith bought acres of black material for the blackout. We'd been under blackout regulations since the first day of evacuation, before the war even began. It meant that nobody, no houses, buildings, shops, or even things like buses or cars, was supposed to show any sort of light outside after the sun went down. That way, if the Germans came to bomb at night, they wouldn't be able to see where any of the cities or villages were. It was harder to hit a dark place than a lit one. For the first month, Miss Smith hadn't bothered covering the windows. She just didn't put any lights on at night. Jamie and I went to bed before the sun went down, so we didn't care. And Miss Smith could sit and brood in a dark room as easily as in a bright one. But now the sun was setting earlier, so Miss Smith made blackout curtains for the upstairs windows, and fabric stretched over frames for the windows downstairs. We stayed up late one Saturday, putting all the blackout up, then turning on all the lights inside. Jamie and I walked around the house outside, looking for any chinks of light, and yelling to Miss Smith when we saw one. She adjusted the curtains until the chinks were gone. Afterward, she made us hot cocoa. "Very good," she said. "I'm sure we'll get used to having the house this dark." She looked almost happy. Almost cheerful for a change. I wondered what it would be like if Jamie and I really were stuck here all winter. I hated winter in the flat. So cold. Miss Smith had a fireplace in the main room. She could burn coal. "I haven't had my sewing machine out since Becky died," she continued. "It felt good to be making something, even if it was only those awful curtains. I suppose I might run up a few things for the two of you." Miss Smith had made us try on all the clothes Lady Thornton brought, and give back whatever didn't fit. She'd also thrown away the clothes we'd come from London in. Still, I had 3 blouses, 2 skirts, 2 sweaters, a dress, a coat, and a pair of riding pants. More clothes than I'd owned in my lifetime. I couldn't imagine needing anything else. "Dressing gowns," Miss Smith said, as though reading my mind. "For winter. Something warm you can ride in. Perhaps something pretty. The red dress is very nice, but it's not the best colour for you." She looked at me in a way that gave me the feeling of being a fish on a slab. "Blue, perhaps. Or a nice bottle green. Green's a good colour with your complexion." "Velvet? I loved the velvet dress I had as a girl." "I hate velvet," I said. She laughed. "You wouldn't know velvet if your underwear was made from it," she said. "Ada, that's a fib." "Why?" I said, "I don't want you making me things." Her smile faded. "Why not?" I shrugged. I had more than I needed, more than I felt comfortable with, really. I was still the girl I'd seen in the train station mirror, still the feeble-minded girl stuck behind a window, the simple one. I was okay with wearing Maggie's cast-offs, but I knew my limits. Jamie leaned forward.
"Will you make me a velvet?" he asked.
Miss Smith's smile returned.
"I will not," she said. "I'll make you something stout and manly."
Jamie nodded.
"Like in the book," he said.
"In the book, that stupid Swiss family Robinson was all the time making and finding things. It was like magic, it was, how the father would think it was a shame they didn't have any wheat for bread. And next thing, they'd stumble onto a whole wheat field, or a wild pig would run out of the forest just when they got a hankering for bacon. They'd build a mill to grind the wheat to flour, and a smokehouse for the pork, out of nails and wood they just happened to have on hand." Jamie loved it. He begged for more of the story every night. "I was tired of those idiots living on an island with everything they could ever want. I didn't care if I never heard another word."
"You won't have time to make us anything," I said. "We won't be here that long."
Miss Smith paused. "The war doesn't seem to be moving very quickly," she said. "Right." More and more of the evacuated children had gone back to London, but not us. Not yet.
"You'll be glad to get rid of us,"
I said. You didn't want us in the first place.